If you want to learn where the next opportunity lies in multifamily real estate in this part of the market cycle, listen to this next episode.
Hello, everybody. Jake Senzio, host Jake and Gino podcast, with my co-host, multifamily mentor, the coach, chef, father, six, the best-selling author, Gene Daddy, Gino Barber. Gene, how's it going,
Mr. Stenziano? I'm doing good. Ask me why I'm doing good, Jake.
Because you're late, and you're probably doing something fun and not, you know, doing your job. Is that
That's the first
here?
Thing. Yes, I was late. Number one, but I did not spend 9 hours this weekend on my house working on my house, so I feel really good not doing that. And for all the listeners out there, rent, don't buy. Go out and rent an apartment.
Self-serving proposition. All right, gang. Today we're honored to have the principal of Origins Investments and a regular expert contributor to Forbes, Entrepreneur, and HuffPost. His team manages more than 5,000 multifamily units in 11 cities across 8 states and has never produced a realized loss for any of their investment partners, period. So without further ado, Michael Episcope, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Jake. And just so the listeners know, that comment that Gino made was directed at me. I spent 9 hours on Saturday fixing my front door because we were talking about how hard it is to get labor. And if you have these small projects at home, the question is, who's going to come over and do these things? So it's generally when you're a homeowner, you're pointing at the person who owns the house. So that was my 9 hours. My back's killing me. It's not that fun anymore. I'm a lot older than I used to be, but that's the nature of owning a home. I'd rather be renting.
I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. You, Mike, we've been there. Jake and Gino are the IMA guys. We're still the IMA guys. Mr. Stenziano over there is smiling because he'll whip out the chainsaw at a moment's notice and start ripping
Gino,
stuff
down
of his house.
Okay, that's therapy. I buy land just to cut down trees. Okay, that's what I do because I'm a redneck and I love it. But hey, here's the deal. I mean, there's you know, you learn things by doing these shows. Like if you hear a banging, you know, that's because his 18-year-old son is behind him. He's got to keep him quiet. And I told him to just beat his ass, but he seems to be a little more gentle than me. So there's a lot going on. There's a lot of dynamics today. But anyways, let's get into the meat and potatoes here. Want to hear about your journey getting into multifamily. Like we were talking about before the show, we started buying a small multifamily unit, refinancing proceeds, and rolling them up into bigger deals. What was your journey like into this space?
Well, I'll take you way back. So my journey really started when I was probably about 12, 13 years old. My grandfather was in multifamily real estate, bought some really tough projects, West Side in the 1970s, when you can buy things on, you know, just basically buy the delinquent
tax. He's saying Chicago, folks. West Side Chicago.
Right. Yeah. I'm in Chicago. This is the West Side, rough stuff. But I had a blast. It was summertime. I used to go there, help him. We used to, you know, go to scrap yards, things like that. And he really was, you know, taught me how to, you know, kind of be scrappy. And, you know, that's the best way to put it about, you know, building these things out, how you operated these things. And I was sort of learning by osmosis at that time. And so that was really my first foray. Left there in my teenage years, didn't come back to it till I was late 30s. And between those years, I actually, I was a commodities trader in my first career. And that's really where I built my wealth. And my partner and I came together in 07. And looking at the environment and having been an LP with big institutions, with smaller groups, things like this, this was kind of pre-Jobs Act, before the market, there was like a proliferation of deals out there. And we just said, we can do this better. And in the beginning, if you think about the world in 07, 08, 09, capital had all the leverage and we were agnostic about what asset class we wanted to be in. We were in self-storage, we were in retail, we were industrial, we were in office, we were in multifamily, everything. And over the years though, we have really honed in on just multifamily. So
Why is that?
You know, first of all, from an organizational standpoint, you want to specialize. You want to know everything you can about an asset to know the expenses, to know the rents, where everybody in your organization, the investment management, the acquisitions team, has a really good handle on what it means to build value, what a good deal looks like. And if you're in all asset classes, you really can't develop that kind of expertise, that inch wide and a mile deep. The other thing is, it's just a better message to the market. when you go out to a broker or you go out to the market and they say, hey, what do you do? And you say, we do everything. What they hear is you don't really specialize. You don't do anything that well. But when you do one thing and that's all you do every day, you wake up, you know, the data set, you know, the information, you know, what you need to do to make money. The other thing is, as you look at multifamily real estate, it's produced some of the best risk adjusted returns over the last 10, 20, 30, 40 years. And that's what it means to us, is that it's about protecting our wealth, growing our wealth in a way that we are confident that we can do that going forward. And the multifamily, the demographics are setting up really, really well for the future. We're in sort of a little blip right now, but that's kind of the abbreviated version of how we got here today. They were just choices along the way. And I think where we are today, we're in a really good spot.
We talk about multifamily as a basic human need. It's food, clothing, and apartments, everybody. That's one of the, well, it's one of the attractions for us. And I think the other thing, Michael, we've talked about the term. One of our frameworks is buy right, manage right, finance right. But the other framework is the three pillars of real estate, which is market cycle, debt, and exit strategy. And you were talking about market cycle before we started recording. Talk about the market cycle, how it's shifted over the last 6 months. I mean, and you haven't bought a deal in the last couple of years. And Jake and I have been very selective. Why buy these assets that are in the C space when we buy newer assets? Our buy right criteria has really shifted over the last, I mean, I guess 6 months to a year. Can you talk about the market cycle a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, real estate, a lot of it is governed by replacement costs. And about 3 years ago, we saw this dynamic setting up where our team was bringing us a lot of value add deals and looking at replacement costs. You're always comparing the two together. And when you see a deal that comes in 10 years old at 270,000 a unit, and you have to put 20,000 into it, and then you have to sell it at a profit, and you're looking at an exit price of 350, 360, 360,000 per unit, and you can build new for 320, you're scratching your head going, why would I buy something that's 10 years old today that's going to be 15 years old when I sell it, when I can build new for less? And so that dynamic was setting up at that time, kind of that 2018-19. And so we build, buy, and lend in multifamily. We haven't bought anything in over 3 years. That equation has only gotten worse since COVID. And we sold a deal in Denver. Last deal we sold, 410,000 a unit. We built that for 220,000 a unit. That was sort of pre-COVID pricing. Today, we can build that deal for 290. And if you know, I mean, this is in the airport area of Denver, Colorado. There's no barriers to entry, and you just scratch your head. And we talked about this too. When it comes to investing, basis is everything. So how do you protect your basis in real estate? And so for us, it's been a barbell strategy. We're either lending, protecting ourselves through the capital structure, or we're building, but we haven't bought anything in years. The market cycle right now, we've seen a huge adjustment in the capital markets. The interest rate movement has probably been, put a number on it, a 3 standard deviation. A year ago, we were sitting here, we were at 1.5%. It's kind of, you know, crazy. I don't think anybody really forecasted what the long-term rates were going to do. So financing today is about 5.5% for institutional multifamily, and it's really created havoc in the markets. There's a huge bid offer. There's no transaction volume. People don't know where cap rates are. They don't know where values are today. And it's completely stalled the market. The Fed has done their job, and they've really taken, you know, the punch bowl away from the
Should
party.
The Fed have done it sooner, though, Michael? If this had been done sooner and slower and gotten the politics out of it, could we have avoided a lot of this, like started raising rates? I know Trump probably should have before COVID, but then once COVID hit, I understand once COVID, but if they had done this a year and a half ago, it would have slowed down the residential slowly, and maybe we wouldn't get up to 7 or 7.5% in the residential.
Gina, you're asking the wrong question. Should they not have printed so much money?
Well, and look, we can play armchair quarterback we want. The Fed almost always gets it wrong. They're either too early, too late, but generally they're too late in these things. But candidly, I agree with Jake. These programs, they kept putting more and more money out after it was obvious that the economy was getting back on track. They didn't need the last $2-4 trillion to do this. And that is really what's caused this.
But we need student loan bailout. We need more. We need more. Give us more money.
But, okay, so what
something to say about that?
My point though is that's going to happen. We can't stop that. The Fed could raise rates sooner. I mean, like the government printing money, that's something that's going to be inevitably going to happen. If
they cannot get out of their own way, they cannot help themselves.
That's what I'm saying. So that's something we have to just take take it for granted. That's happening. But they could have started raising rates a lot sooner, and the home prices here would have slowed down. Things would have slowed down. And if everyone understands economics, when rates rise, there's always a recession. I think we've been in a recession for the last year. Two quarters of negative GDP. That's given. It's just that this one has a little funny twist to it, that there's still jobs, which is really weird. The demand and Correct. The supply yeah. chain has screwed things up. But if they'd slowed things down, they could have tamped down the demand. The supply chain could have caught up. We could now probably be on the downside of like lowering rates and then all of a sudden coming out of the recession. That was just my point. I don't know what your thoughts were.
We
on
like
that.
The ride, yeah. you know.
I'll say, look, you can't do anything. The only thing the Fed can do is look at the data and the information that they have at hand. And it's more than likely they're going to raise rates in November. But we're all sitting here and we know that what they've done has worked. It's pencils down for almost everybody right now in the multifamily real estate. I actually don't think that they need to continue to raise rates right now.
How long does it take until it hits the end user in the economy? I think that's the thing that is confusing. Is it 6 months? Is it 9 months? Is it 12 months? The stuff is working to your point, but as it actually trickle through the entire economy and feel the full impact, I think is a little bit of a wild card. I'm sure that somebody has a better answer than I do, but I think that's the real question is how long does it take once you raise the rates to really feel it and as it actually trickles down through the economy?
Well, I think as it pertains to real estate, some is immediate. Yeah, and then others, you know, in the real estate market right now, the we've already seen the public markets reprice. Those always reprice the fastest. Mm-hmm. Real estate, private real estate, usually lags the public markets by 6 to 18 months. And that's what we've seen. But we've only seen the blow up in the capital market side, the financing cost things, cap rates, things of that nature. The next shoe to drop is really on the operational side. And if the Fed does their job and they create a recession, which looks like this is going to happen, we're going to see an uptick in jobless claims. We're going to see an uptick in unemployment. And what that's going to lead to are lower rents. And there's, by all means, we're most likely going to give some of these rents back, not all of them. We've had this mass migration shift to the South. That's not going to stop. I think the next wave is going to be coming. Over the next 5 years, the market looks great. We still have a massive housing shortage here in the United States. And I will say this, that never in the history of the Fed, when we've gone into a recession, has the 10-year not declined by 150 basis points. So if you look at the 10-year where it is today at 4.2, 4.3%, if you apply that rule, chances are in a year, that 10-year note should be around 3.8 or around there.
Yeah. 2024 is the strike price because everything you're saying, plus there's an election. And I don't give a shit when politics yeah. comes into it. The Fed drops their pants when there's an election and there's always a rate reduction. So I think if you want to refi, you got 2024 on your calendar. That's the year to strike for long-term holds. Maybe it's 4.5. Who the hell knows? But I think that's what we're looking at.
Michael, what do you see sellers becoming cognizant of the fact that they're asking too much and all of a sudden deals aren't penciling out? And I see some deals staying on the market that they're the ones, and brokers are the ones that are like, I can't bring this to market because you're asking too much. It's going to sit. When does that set in? You said 6 to 18 months. We've already been through this for like 3 months. When does that light bell go off?
When they're forced to sell. Sellers, I mean, that's the thing about private real estate. If you have long-term debt, you don't have to sell. If you have a bank who's knocking on your door and says to you, hey, we need another $10 million, $20 million, $30 million. You have two choices. You can either go find that gap equity and you can resize the loan for this new environment we're in, or you can sell the property. So that normally takes a long time, but every seller knows that the capital markets have shut down, that the window to sell. We have two deals in our fund. We sold over $300 million in real estate in 2021, and we got out of a lot of stuff. But we had one deal that didn't close and we're just going to hold it. Now we don't have any choice. And then we have another deal that's being finished right now in Denver. And, we missed the window. But the nice thing is when you're building good real estate in well-located markets and you're financed correctly, you're not over leveraged and you're building the cash flow, you're going to be fine. Because even if you go back to 08, there were plenty of multifamily developers who got through to the other side is if, nothing happened whatsoever. You have to build the cash flow. And that's the big thing that matters today in both the public markets and the private markets.
If it doesn't cash flow, you let the grass grow, Jake. Am I right? Am I wrong? Huh?
Gino, if it don't cash flow, Love you that. Let the grass grow. Yeah. Hey, guys, here's the thing, too. If you're really looking at the last 2 years, there was a ton of money printed. It was pushed into the markets. Investors had money. Their money went to syndicators. Syndicators then went and bid up all the multifamily properties, flipped them 2 and 3 times. Everyone was making money. That's, you know, follow the money. That's where the money went. It was pushed out there, given to syndicators, and then they kept bidding up these properties. Now I'm speaking to brokers, and they're saying, like, what camp do you fall in? And the basically question is, like, are you buying? Are you still trying? Because what's happened to a lot of syndicators now is their capital's dried up. They don't have investors throwing money at them now. So now we're going to see it's supply and demand. Demand is going to fall for these properties. We're seeing deals that would have traded like that, had 20 offers on them 6 months ago. Now they're sitting, and they're still in call for offers mode. Okay? That's what we're seeing already.
I would. Investors haven't even taken any pain yet. I think everybody knows.
But they're shitting their pants though. Like, it's fear based. Right. Okay. Yeah. I'm not saying anyone's felt the pain, but it's like you have PTSD, because especially if you look at investors in the Northeast, right? They went through 9/11. They went through 08. Okay, and then they go through COVID. So it's like every few years, it's like this freak out mode. So I think people are puckering up earlier, and they're saying, "Nah, you're not getting my cash right now. We're holding on." I think that's happening.
And it's going to get worse as soon as they start reporting losses to them.
Correct.
And they have to mark to market.
Yeah.
Capital calls. Let me ask you, Michael, about, you're talking about people who have to sell. Are you worried or concerned about these people that have bought deals in the last 18 months that were stabilized on bridge debt, or ones that had IO that's burning off? Don't you see those as opportunities?
Huge. And I think the opportunities that are going to be coming are really on the credit side. So gap equity, things like that. And that's where banks have pulled back. We're seeing it right now. We just, we have a deal down in Houston that we finished, we built. And yeah, I would say in the last kind of 5, 6, 7 years, you've been able to go and refinance and pull out anywhere between 30 and 70% of your capital on a refinance. And today, the way the banks are operating, they're pulling back. They don't want us to pull any equity out. So we're just getting our loan proceeds out. And by the way, we were leveraged 65% to cost on that deal. So imagine people who got deals out of the ground in the last 6 months, 12 months. And I would say the worst vintages are the second half of 2021 and certainly the first quarter in 2022. Nothing else has happened. But if you're leveraged to 85% and you're not building a tremendous amount of value on the building side, or you're doing value add, when you go to refinance, you're going to need to inject a considerable amount of equity. And so to me, where we see the opportunities over the next, you know, like foreseeable future, is just providing that gap equity to groups who overlevered and haven't been able to meet their business plan and who overpaid for projects too.
Michael, I guess the last question for me before we go to the personal growth, you're seeing all this pain. Where else do you see the opportunity? Where should, when people are starting out in multifamily, where else is the opportunity in multifamily you're seeing over the next, because you're a long-term investor. I think this part of the market cycle is going to bear that out. You just can't buy a deal and flip it for the next.
Gino, he's looking to push back in. I can see it. He's itching. Yeah. He says, pencils down for now. I think pencils up, baby. Let's go.
Pencils up. So, you know, the advantage we have as a firm is we're incredibly agile, and we built 3 products. So we invest along credit, and we also build and we buy, right? We're buy. We told you we're not buying anything. Just the replacement cost doesn't make sense today. Building, we're pencils down. So everything we're doing today is really on the credit side. So we're buying something called K-series bonds, which are collateralized by multifamily. We're also doing preferred equity. And I think you have to be defensively positioned in there until we see this play out, and until you see rents come down, they settle in, occupancy, and sort of some bright light on the other side. But today, I would just say, like, if you're already in real estate and you've made an investment, hopefully you're with a good sponsor, you've leveraged appropriately, you're in the right markets, because over the next 5 years, we're going to be fine, right? It's just getting through this dip over the next kind of 6, 12, 18 months. And we'll get to the other side of that.
Jake, I lied. One more question, brother.
Hold on, Gino. You got to repeat what he said. You got to be in the right market. You got to be in the right market, and you got to be with an operator. That's key right now. All right, Gino, I'm sorry.
Well, floor, operator, baby. Market, vintage, also the right business plan where you're holding long-term.
Well, leverage too, guys. That's a huge part of it, right? Yeah, I mean, you can be in the right market.
Don't buy a bridge. Yeah.
Monster. Yeah. You know, if you're at 85%, your equity is probably gone right now, because the markets are easily down across the board 15% on a gross level. So if you've only put 15% in, guess what? Goodbye.
He just said buy equity. Right, manage right, and finance right.
Yeah.
Basically. Michael, can you just discuss the difference between 08 and what's going on right now? And this, because you said before, I think we started recording, this is not 08. This is something a little bit different. You know, we're going to get a dip, like, but you know, 08 is completely different than what's going on right now.
Yeah, a lot of what we're seeing today, especially the shortage in housing, is a result of 08. The banks have been out of the market for 10 years, no spec properties. So we still have a shortage of 4 million housing units. And that was very different when we were going into 06, 07, where there was overbuilding. If you could fog a mirror, you could, you know, basically get a loan at that time. The capital markets for the last 10 years have been behaving normally. The banks have been lending. They actually did put in really good regulation. So this is, to me, this is more like 2001, where we had a tech wreck in 2001. Everything got caught up into it. You had short-term interest rates go to 8%. This is not a real estate-led recession with over-leverage. You're going to have some pain in it in every sector. And we've seen that in the public market, especially. But this is just a normal cycle. And every, you know, good operator should be able to get through to the other side and continue to do deals, you know, in 24 and beyond.
Michael, aren't you happy, though, that this is happening right now? This is normal. And I think for people out there saying, we get a lot of students saying, hey, you know, I didn't want to start in 18 and 19 because the market's really hot. Now they look at it, go, I can't get into real estate now because it's about to crater. You're only ready when you're ready. It's never the right time. If you're an operator and you're an investor, you can make money when the market's going up and you can make money when the market's going down. And you really need to look at this as an entrepreneurial venture. You're a business person. You're creating an enterprise. You have systems. And I think people lose sight of that as real estate. That's what we love about multifamily. We're creating multifamily entrepreneurs, not just by buying one or two assets and being landlords, but actually asset managing it and operating these assets as well.
Yeah, I'll tell you, your first question, am I happy about this? It's hard to be happy about
a I'm sorry. I didn't mean you're jumping up and down and going, yeah, we're
bullshit. Gino's happy. He wants to get some meat. Gino wants to eat right now. He wants to buy some deals. That's what he's happy about.
Yes. I'm happy about a balance coming back into the market. And we have seen that sponsors and contractors and builders and they have had so much leverage over the last 4 years that they've been naming their price. And right now, with all of these,
not to mention employees, let's be clear. It's like everybody is just beating down the business.
Yeah. It's so different. So I am happy that there will be a balance back into the market and that there's a normal cycle. I'll tell you, I wasn't that excited. Like, we did really well in the last couple of years. But the fact that we've had 5 years of growth brought forward and we're in these unprecedented volatile times, I don't love this. And we're going to see this roller coaster ride for the next 2, 3, 4 years through supply chain disruptions. There's price discovery in interest rates. We've got what's going on in the job market right now. And so you have just a tremendous amount of volatility. This isn't going to work itself out in the next 2 or 3 years. And I think this is going to be the hangover from COVID, just as the hangover from 08 was this housing shortage.
That's the key, though, because even let's just take used cars for an example. And Gino's sick of me talking about used cars. But ultimately, what's going to happen is you're seeing them sit longer now. Okay. And then you're going to see supply next year start to come back stronger and you're seeing higher interest rates. So this is going to help normalize and level out the economy because getting a used car, you couldn't get a new car last year, first of all. So you had to buy used and you're paying way over. So it's very frustrating. But now with higher rates, higher costs, you know, the supply coming back, I think it normalizes some of these sectors like the used car market.
Hey, Jake, I lied again. Another question I got to ask Michael.
Hold on. He was going to say something.
Well, Jake, I want to, because that's a good analogy. I just bought a new car for my son. And you're looking,
Dude, what are you doing? The guy's sleeping till noon. You're just buying him a car. Okay, good. All right. Hopefully he's working, right?
But the thing, like, I couldn't pull the trigger on a used car because I'm like, how can I buy a 3-year-old car
justifying
for almost the same price as a brand new car? That you're right. That'll work itself out. And guess what? The used car market is going to crash. And I would say
I think it's going to implode. I really do. Yeah.
We have been seeing 20-year-old product trade above replacement cost in real estate. And guess what? When new supply comes online and these things work itself out, if you are caught in 15, 20, 25-year-old product that's anywhere near replacement cost, that will come into balance as well. And you want to be in that new product, those blue chips today, and just steer away from that older vintage product, unless you bought it right, really far below replacement cost. But that's what I see happening in the next, you know, kind of 2 to 3 years as well, is those fundamentals coming back into line too.
Jake, one more question. Just one more. Can I throw one more at him?
Yeah, man.
Okay. One more. And you said you're a commodities trader. We in the U.S., we're a little bit in a bubble. What do you think about energy prices affecting Europe? I mean, like, Europe, I think, is going to get crushed. And I think in the Northeast, where my friends are paying $5 for a gallon of heating oil, I mean, for the average person, that's going to wipe out everything for them as well. I mean, I think the energy, I mean, you're seeing manufacturing plants in Europe.
Is it really that
down.
Much?
Dude, it's $5 a gallon. You're talking heating oil. It for my house, it cost me like $1,500 a month to heat my house in New York. It's
and Gino
a joke.
Keeps it at like 66, too.
Dude, I'm running around. No, fucking the kids are running around. Nah, 672. The kids are running around half naked, too, in my house. Yeah,
right.
Yeah. No, it's like 67. I got the parkas on, bro. You know, you feel me. You know what I'm saying? But it's insane. Like, let's talk about energy. I mean, the reality of what they've done with the energy policy is going to really disrupt Europe as well. And I think that's going to be a major, I guess, linchpin for recession as well.
Yeah, you're getting out a little bit outside of my expertise. I don't study Europe a lot. I will tell you that Germany is in a real conundrum right now, because if you go back, you understand the history of World War II, what happened there, and then they signed this deal with Putin 25 years ago, and Putin knew that he had them once they were dependent on that Russian oil, and here they are buying Russian oil to fuel this war against Ukraine. I mean, they can't sleep at night right now, and that whole thing is terrible. But yes,
they're stuck.
Yeah, they're stuck. Exactly. Because they signed the deal with the devil, and they were actually in the process of signing another deal with the devil. And who there ever thought about the national security? I mean, it's kind of silly when you look at the whole thing, trusting a guy like that. Energy is a huge problem everywhere. I here in the United States, too. I mean, we're looking, I don't even know where, you know, oil is today. But hopefully this will, you know, if we get a recession, we don't know where these things go. It's anybody's guess from here. I know that OPEC just cut production by 2%. Doesn't sound like a lot, but energy, it always seems to go in the direction that it hurts the most people.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that's a huge component to everything as well, because if there's cheap energy, that helps to reduce inflation, right? That's going to bring the cost down everything. So when the energy goes up, it makes inflation that much worse. So, All right, guys, let's take a quick time out here from our sponsor.
Get involved in multifamily, this is where you need to be.
The team you've built is incredible.
There is no egos here. Everyone is always looking to help the other person.
All right, we are back. Give the folks out there, say you're starting off in multifamily, what is a great tip for someone looking to scale their business?
Jake, are you talking about like people who are buying direct?
Yeah, I think if you're starting out, regardless if you're syndicating, you know, to start out, and maybe you can speak to that a little bit more, starting a company like that. When you're starting out in the multifamily space, you know, I think for some folks, they may look at it as an investment, but this is truly a business. Yeah. And in your experience, what were some of the hurdles or corrections that you made along your way to help systematize and scale up your company?
Yeah, the two best pieces of advice, I can tell you that you have to be obsessed with two things. Number one, returns, and the other is client service. And we talk about that internally. And you can't have one without the other. So if you produce great returns, but you're black box, people will not give you more money. If you produce, you know, if you're reporting, but your returns are awful, same thing. You can actually have average returns, but provide great client service and communication and do very well. I would just say that when you're starting out, you have to bring people deals that are practically bulletproof, because that is really going to set you up for success. And that's kind of what we did. When we look back 15 years ago, we were buying debt from banks, we were buying deals. And at the time, we could have capitalized those with our own money. But we said, look, what do we want to be when we grow up? Let's bring this deal out and create this network of investors. And you just have to show them a great experience from day one and prove what you can do for them, because you want to get beyond your network. And the best thing you can have is people telling their friends about how great you are.
So don't try to thread the needle, wait for a solid double and execute on that sucker and treat people nice. Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. My pleasure. I got it. Check
no, no Chick-fil-A reference in this podcast yet. What's going on?
I just did.
I know.
Okay.
I just mentioned it.
any book recommendations, anything that you've read in the last few years that would benefit the folks?
100%. Yeah, I was just given this by somebody in our IR group. It's called The Psychology of Money. By far the easiest and best read I've ever had. Like,
who wrote it, Michael? Who's the author?
That's a really good question. I can't tell you, but there's only it might have been Zweig, the reporter. So, but it's a really good book, and it basically talks about. I mean, I can give you the 2 cents.
Tell me, yeah, tell me the psychology of money. I want to know.
Well, it comes down to this, that it's not about what you know, but how you behave, right? Those are the people who make the most money. And I didn't know this was an interesting fact, but Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger, they had a third partner. This goes back to the 1970s, and somebody asked him about his third partner, and Charlie, so eloquently as he puts it, he said, look, Warren and I knew that we were going to be wealthy, right? But it would take time. And our other partner was impatient. So in the 1970s, he decided, you know, with all his wisdom, to leverage his stock in Berkshire Hathaway. And ultimately he got called because it was a period of, you know, 4 or 5 standard deviations. The market just kept going down. And Charlie and Warren bought him out because he had to sell. And 98% of their wealth came after the age of 65. Because they just kept making good bets and letting it compound in the money. And that was really interesting. And there were other stories in it about, you know, how is it the janitor who doesn't have any education can actually outperform the individual who's got an MIT education? And they go through stories like this that are great. And one of them that I really loved was, look, the other thing you got to do is don't cross those lines. And they gave countless examples of people who are really smart, made a lot of wealth, who became greedy, who ultimately ended up in jail as a result because they just wanted more and more and more. And so the book has all these great anecdotes, these stories. It's broken up into chapters that are, you know, 6 pages each, and every chapter is, you know, something you can learn about. And I highly recommend that.
Michael, do they talk in The Psychology of Money how people are more afraid of losing money than actually trying to make money? Their fear is if they rather fear of losing that $1 is stronger than actually gaining $5. Do they talk about that in that book?
100%, but it's all, the whole book is about fear and greed. And it's like, why do wealthy people, this was a really good quote. Why do people bet what they need and I don't even know, like what they need and have for what they don't have and don't need, right? And so we all know people who said those awful words, I used to be rich. And you look at that, but that's what it comes down to, right? They were very comfortable. They had the money, and yet they wanted more and more and more. And they risk what they have, they built and need for their lifestyle for something that they didn't really. They wanted the yacht. They wanted the private planes. They wanted this. And guess what? They're now in the poorhouse. And that book, I think, is a must read for everybody. I've given it to my kids.
Gino, don't lose money. Rule number one.
Rule number one.
Don't lose money, man.
What's rule number two, Jake?
Make more money.
Go back to rule number one, bro. Yeah. That's what rule number two is.
Last question. What project are you excited about right now?
Well, we were just in Colorado Springs with our entire team looking. We have 3 projects there. Colorado Springs, great market. Love that entire area. Drafts off Denver. I would say those, you know, all 3 of those projects are just that market in general. I get more excited about markets and, you know, than the individual projects. Jacksonville is a great market as well. We like that. Gino, I know you're familiar with that. We got a project we're looking at in St. Augustine. So hopefully when this market recovers, we'll be hitting the ground, ready to go. You know, whatever project we can make money on, honestly. So it's market by market today.
Gino, you ready to take us home?
I am. This is going to be a very enjoyable wrap up because Michael at a young age of 12 years old, he's the IMA mentality. Grandpa's telling him, go demo the unit, Michael. Michael's like, yeah, I like this real estate stuff. But then he says, you know what? It's too much work. I'm gonna go to college. I'm gonna become one of those hedge fund guys, one of those evil guys. I'm gonna make my money in that market, in that industry. And he makes a pile of money. In 2007, he sees the dislocation of the market, and all of a sudden he understands that real estate, it's an amazing place to do it. And he starts buying these deals, starts getting a lot of investors on board, makes a ton of money from, you know, 07 to 19. In 2019, he slams on the brakes and goes, this replacement cost thing, this is not working for him. It doesn't make any sense. Puts the pencil down. He's not pencil whipping a deal. I am not making up these numbers. I'm not going to go out and buy a deal. I'm going to buy right, manage right, and finance right. And if it don't cash flow, I let the grass grow, people. So I'm waiting. I'm waiting for, as he says, he doesn't say it this way, but he's waiting for blood in the streets. He's waiting for the markets to recalibrate themselves. And he's going to go out and make some money in this next market cycle.
I think that's spot on. Michael, what's the best way for folks to get a hold of you?
They can email me directly, michael@origininvestments.com. I'll direct them to the right place. Our website is also a great resource, origininvestments.com. You can download all of our fund decks. You can engage with somebody from our investor relations department, schedule a call, whatever you need to do, or investorrelations@origininvestments.com.
Awesome. Gang, as always, we believe in buying deals for the long term. Think in decades. I'm Jake. He's a G-Daddy. We make it happen. We'll see you next time. Thanks, gang.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you both.